The beauty and power of all that has come before in this service leaves me practically speechless, but not quite. As a people of faith, grounded in our principles, we cultivate lives of meaning and reverence and depth. We create sanctuary where all hands are held. Together we act toward justice and healing and sustainability. To act together asks us to look at who we are and to pass the torch of the light that has been given to us, each in our own unique and irreplaceable lives. And the light that has been given to this community, in this time, in this place, that in generations to come, our children will find their light and our congregation will find its light. That our quest for community, for purpose, for progressive religious presence in the world will find its light in new ways, in new words, in new actions. For we believe that revelation is not sealed, answering now to our endeavor. Truths and justice are revealed. That which came to ancient sages, Greek and pagan and Roman, Jew, Islamic, Muslim, Buddhist, that which came to ancient sages is written in the soul's deep pages and it shines today, forever new. Those words of a hymn that I sang as a child carry me forward into each new era of my personal life, of our life as a congregation, of our life as a religious movement within the country and in the context of this beloved, magnificent planet Earth, whose bounty and grace we did nothing to deserve, but who gives and gives and gives to us. Who we are is in part determined by our commitments, our affiliations, by our answer to the question, to whom do we belong? To whom do you belong? Who we are in part determined by our affiliations and in part determined by our inherent nature, that we are dreams and bones. William Greenleaf Elliott, minister before the Civil War in St. Louis, Missouri, was contacted in the middle of writing a sermon, a moment never to interrupt another person, by his wife, who had gone to the butcher's and found there a person of conscience who had taken the risk to hide and to discuss with someone, this woman that he trusted, the life of a runaway slave. William Greenleaf Elliott had that moment of choice. And so he got up from writing that sermon He abandoned all of the scholarship laid out in book after book around him in his library. He went to the butcher's and he took that person into his home. A while later, he went off to visit a dying member and saw some people loitering around his house, but left and returned that evening to find that those people had been slave catchers, had beaten the gentleman, terrified William Greenleaf Elliot's household, and taken the slave into the county jail, drawing on his Boston precision. A highly educated gentleman, he went immediately to the letter of the law and found out that a slave catcher could not capture someone until 30 days had passed, that slave was missing. This was day 29. He wrote up all the appropriate things. He wrote quite well. He contacted all the appropriate people. He had many contacts, and took that person out of jail, who immediately went off from St. Louis, up to Alton, Illinois, where he could be free. What would make the difference in your life? If in the midst of your busy tasks, immersed in your own interests, you were presented with a question like that. Science tells us that the way our brains perceive things is in categories, and we have to train ourselves not to show favoritism. Reported in BillMoyers.com, Chris Mooney writes to us about a study in which subjects were asked to rate how much they like a wide variety of paintings put into two different groups. They were, in actuality, completely random paintings put into two different groups. One was named red, one was named green. And then the participants were sorted into two groups, red or green. You're the reds, you're the greens. Not based on which group you had said you liked, but instead you're made to think that everyone in this group, this side of the aisle, loved the red school of art. And here were lovers of the green school of art, completely randomly mixed. And so then you're tested later on, and people consistently, even us, bless us, show favoritism toward the arbitrary color group to which you have been assigned. When asked to allocate money to the other participants, the majority of reds generously favor other reds, despite the fact that they've never met them and it's all been arbitrarily assigned. And the majority of greens more generously fund the greens, because you've been told this is your identity, because you've been told this is the we to which you belong. You know, in order to rid the world of prejudice, we can't simply snuff out our inherited biological evolutionary natures. We can't fundamentally remake the human brain with our rapid-fire associations and categorizing, our essentializing, our groupish tendencies. It turns out from this and a whole series of studies that the very best intervention in our automatic responses to define ourselves and maintain our affiliation to our identified group is narrative. It's the stories we tell. In one study, participants are asked to read an evocative story told in second-person narrative in which a white man assaults the participant and a black man rescues the participant. In other words, the study induces people to feel as if they've been personally helped or even saved by someone from a different race. And then they take a battery of tests, and they find that they are far, far less likely to test prejudice or bias. This is called epistemic unfreezing, unfreezing those automatic responses by telling stories that draw a wider circle, that walk the road between the two sides, or between, because here we are in three dimensions, up, down, right, left, north, south, east, and west, that we situate ourselves at the center of a vast series of axes along which we have been told to define ourselves and move ourselves intentionally along the path. That's the science of it. Who we are, the legacy, the torch, the light we pass along, is within our heartfelt commitment and power. Poetically speaking, the Native American poet Joy Harjo writes a map to the next world, with which I'll end. In the last days of the fourth world, I wished to make a map for those who would climb through the hole in the sky, and my only tools were the desires of humans as they emerged from the killing fields, from the bedrooms, from the kitchens. For the soul is a wanderer with many hands and many feet. The map is made of sand, and it can't be read by ordinary light. It must carry fire to the next tribal town for renewal of the spirit. In the legend are instructions on the language of the land and how it was we forgot to acknowledge the gift as if we were not in it or of it. We must take note of the proliferation of supermarkets and malls and the altars of money, for they best describe the detour from grace. Let us keep track of the errors of our forgetfulness. The fog steals our children while we sleep. Flowers of rage spring up in the depression. Monsters are born there of nuclear anger. Trees of ashes wave goodbye and goodbye, and the map appears to disappear. We no longer know the names of the birds here or how to speak to them by their personal names. Once we knew everything in this lush promise. What I'm telling you is real and is printed in a warning on the map. Our forgetfulness stalks us, walks the earth behind us, leaving a trail of paper diapers, needles, washed blood. An imperfect map will have to do, little one. The place of entry is the sea of your mother's blood, your father's small death, as he longs to know himself into another. We were never perfect, Yet the journey we make together is perfect on this earth, who was once a star and made the same mistakes as humans. We might make them again, she says. Crucial to finding the way is this. There is no beginning or end. You must make your own map. Together, we must find our way.